Welcome to Soil Stories with Nick and Leanna.
Episode 8, Balancing the Scale with Nutrient Management. Today we're talking about soil chemical properties through the lens of soil fertility and nutrient management in agriculture. Nutrient management involves many stakeholders, from farmers to policymakers, and it goes way beyond plant nutrition. While that's an important piece of this puzzle, there's a whole body of science dedicated to soil testing and analysis. And on top of that, there's public and policy interests at stake here too. To break down the complexity of this topic, I'm excited to host several stakeholders who are working in nutrient management to share some of their perspectives. To get us started, we really need to talk about what we mean by nutrients.
Well, I think it's important. So we use the term nutrient, and really we're talking about plant essential elements. So elements that are required for plant growth and development.
This is John Jones. John works with researchers and also policymakers to improve nutrient management.
So my name is John Jones. I'm the director of the Foundation for Agronomic Research, and I direct research for the Fertilizer Institute as well. I'm originally from a small farm just north of Madison, Wisconsin, and I did my undergraduate at Kansas State University and then my master's and PhD in soil fertility and sustainable agriculture at Iowa State University. So essentially, I'm a farm kid who stayed in school too long.
In many ways, nutrient management is identifying these plant essential nutrients and trying to balance them. There's many different ways to look at this balancing act. It could be environmental versus crop production, or the balance could be just within the field itself and trying to get those plants the nutrients they need.
Nutrient management is basically kind of checks and balances. It's a way to balance what nutrients you have in the field. You usually can find this out through soil testing. And then utilizing nutrient sources, whether it's manure or commercial fertilizers, to try to balance out those nutrients based on whatever kind of crop you're trying to grow in that field.
That was Melissa Wilson. Melissa is an assistant professor and extension specialist in manure management and water quality at the University of Minnesota. In her position, Melissa is engaging with many stakeholders involved in nutrient management and soil fertility.
Yeah, definitely a lot of stakeholders. I work with a lot of people in my job. I don't know if I mentioned that I do research, but I also have an extension role. I'm the state manure specialist. I know, great title, but we work with a lot of folks. We work with farmers directly. We work with commercial manure haulers, certified crop consultants who might actually be helping farmers with their nutrient management plans. And we work with some of the, like, I would say regulatory and also agency staff.
To develop a nutrient management plan, Melissa and other extension researchers, as well as farmers and crop consultants, rely on soil testing.
Well, soil testing is really the first step in developing any kind of nutrient management plan.
That was John Brecker with AgVice Laboratories out of Northwood, North Dakota. AgVice serves many customers, including researchers at the University of Minnesota. In fact, AgVice has provided some soil testing data for me and my own research projects.
Soil testing is our way of learning how much of that particular nutrient or a suite of nutrients that a soil might contain and a plant's ability to access those nutrients. So if a producer is trying to grow a crop, he wants to make sure that his crops don't run out of nutrients, we'll say nitrogen or phosphorus. And so soil testing is that first step in figuring out how much the soil provides in that nutrient balance. And then after we figure out how much the soil can provide, the farmer then figures out how much fertilizer he needs to add to make up the difference and maximize his yield. In the same step, it's important to figure out what the soil provides because the farmer doesn't want to apply too much fertilizer for a couple reasons. One, it is an economic decision where he doesn't want to put fertilizer dollars that aren't needed into his field. And the second is an environmental reason, because he doesn't want to apply too many nutrients that could be potentially lost if they're not taken up by his plants. And so soil testing is kind of that first step in gathering the information that a producer requires to figure out largely how much fertilizer, when to apply that fertilizer, and where to apply that fertilizer in his fields.
As John explained, nutrient management and soil testing go hand in hand, and it's soil testing that allows us to develop nutrient recommendations. He touched on the balance we must keep in mind as farmers, crop consultants, and researchers, that we need to maximize crop production while minimizing nutrient losses to the environment. But farmers need a baseline to use in order to get started with soil testing. So we use what we call a routine soil test. This includes certain nutrients and also other soil properties.
Growers are interested in, you know, the primary nutrients that we'd be concerned with. So that'd be nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. In Minnesota, one of the more important micronutrients for corn production would be zinc. So a pretty common soil test would be NPK, zinc, as well as some very basic soil properties like soil pH, soil salinity, and also organic matter. So I think those seven items are probably the most requested. As we get a little bit farther west, like into the Dakotas, where cropping systems are a little bit more diverse at times than corn, soybeans, and alfalfa, like in, say, southeast Minnesota. Once you start getting into small grains, we start thinking about copper and chloride as important micronutrients. You know, you get into canola or alfalfa, maybe boron is another important micronutrient. But 99% of the tests are probably those basic ones that I talked about, NPK and those basic soil properties.
Before we can analyze the sample for nutrient content and other soil properties, we first need to dry and grind the sample. To understand this logic, we need to remember that soils are living biomes with constant chemical and biological fluxes. Drying is very important because it stops many of these biological and chemical processes, and it also provides a uniform moisture content. This is very important in order to have a representative sample.
The whole part of soil testing and delivering a numerical result at the end is about sampling and representative sampling. So if you think about all the soil in a given field, there's a lot of soil out there, but you can't send the entire field into the laboratory for sampling or for analysis. So you take a sample of that, and that's why you have the soil cores. And then after we get that sample, it gets dried, ground down to homogenize that subsample of the entire field that the producer's working with. And from that subsample, really in analysis, we only usually require a few grams of soil to actually conduct the analysis. As you downsize the sample from the entire population, like the field, to this small bag of soil, to that small couple grams that we might actually run through an instrument, that we have a homogeneous sample throughout that entire process. So drying and grinding the sample is very, very important.
Once the sample is properly dried and homogenized, we can start our chemical analyses. There are many different types of chemical analyses that can be done on soils in order to reveal their nutrient content. However, not every nutrient is easy to test for. Nitrogen, one of the major contributors to pollution, is one of these nutrients.
One of the more difficult nutrients to predict is nitrogen. And it kind of depends where you're at in the United States for the usefulness of the soil nitrate test. So in a crop's growing cycle, there's going to be nitrogen that is mineralized from organic matter. And that's a really difficult nutrient to try to pin down because mineralization reactions are so dependent on weather and climate. So if you are in the, what I'm going to call the humid east, it's hard to pin down that number because residual nitrate and just the wetness of the environment often causes nitrate loss. So testing for nitrate in an environment like that is very difficult. Where I live, I'm kind of on the edge of where we make that transition from the humid east to the semi-arid west. And at that point, our environment is not only dry enough, but we also slip into this 10-month deep freezer called winter. And it freezes the soil and stops some of those biological reactions, and it also stops nitrate from leaching. So we can kind of use the soil nitrate test as a way to figure out how much nitrogen is currently hanging around, and we can credit towards that next year's crop. So it's one more tool, but it still doesn't answer the question of how much nitrogen is going to be mineralized that next year. So nitrate's kind of one of these tricky ones, depending on where you are and what your environment is like, that you can help use that soil nitrate information to fill in your total budget for nitrogen that that crop may need in the upcoming growing season.
So nitrogen might be a little bit difficult to predict, and it's very difficult to test for a nutrient that might be changing throughout a growing season. We see this issue in Minnesota, where we have this divide between humid east and dry west, which John touched on a bit. So in Minnesota, we know that we can use the nitrate test in only parts of the state, and that is only a baseline to get us started. It won't necessarily tell us what happens in the soil throughout the rest of the season. In contrast, potassium and phosphorus tend to remain pretty static in the soil. They're what we would consider relatively stable. When I say stable, I mean that they can complex with the soil. They might form precipitates, or they might bind or adsorb to the soil surface. Considering that these nutrients are stable, a grower might get a soil test value back for potassium and phosphorus, and then wonder, what do I apply for fertilizer? Well, the university has come up with a method in order to create these fertilizer recommendations, and these are based off of our soil test values.
So when you get a soil test number back, it's really just a number. The next step in making sense of that is the step we call soil test interpretation, where we provide context and figure out, you know, really what is the importance of that number. So researchers will do field trials where they have a bunch of different sites across a range of these different soil test levels, and they apply different rates of fertilizer at each site. And so they figure out at what point or at what soil test level does that crop not need any more fertilizer. And so with that, they can figure out, you know, the proper soil test levels and the proper amount of fertilizer required at each soil test level in each site. So when a farmer sends us a soil sample and they're expecting a nutrient recommendation, well, we take their soil sample, figure out what their soil test level is, and then using that university research data, we take the response curves that are generated, and that's how we figure out that final nutrient recommendation and the rate of fertilizer that's required.
As a result of soil testing, we are able to tell where in the field we need nutrients and where we do not. And this is really beneficial to growers, as they can save money if they don't have to apply a nutrient uniformly across a whole field. And this is what we call variable rate.
Soils are landscapes. And if you've ever looked at a field, some fields are very flat and they look uniform. Other fields have notable topography in them. And topography is one of the five soil forming factors, and where that soil may be located on the landscape influences how it forms. And as it forms, it has different biological, different chemical, and different physical properties. And all of those things influence nutrient availability to plants. It also influences how well a crop can grow and what its nutrient requirements may be. So when you vary your nutrient and you figure out exactly how much is needed in each part of the field, it maximizes your economic return, because as the crop nutrient requirements vary across the field, you're investing your dollars in the right place. So you're maximizing your return in each place, because some areas of the fields might need more nutrients, some areas of the field might not need as many nutrients. While you're doing that, you are simultaneously limiting environmental losses, because if you have a area of the field that might be a little bit sandier, you don't want to put too much nitrogen there, because that area might be at greater risk of nitrate leaching. So it allows you to prevent under application in the areas that need more nutrients, and it also prevents over application in the areas of the field that do not need them.
Variable rate is a useful tool for fertilizer and nutrient management. But things get a little bit trickier when we consider manure as our fertilizer source. Manure not only has many nutrients, but they are not all equally distributed in the manure. We're going to get different amounts of different nutrients.
You find all of the nutrients in manure. It's one of the kind of benefits of it compared to commercial fertilizers, is you get all the macronutrients, you get the secondary, you get the micronutrients. The problem is with manure is that it might not be in a ratio that's perfect for crop uptake. For for instance, usually plants want about 4 parts of nitrogen to every 1 part of phosphorus that they take up, at least the crops that we typically grow. And manure in many cases might have 2 parts nitrogen to 1 part phosphorus, or even have a 1-to-1 ratio. So that's kind of our, you know, big things we have to worry about is that ratio.
In many cases, this skewed ratio makes it really difficult for farmers to know how much manure to apply. The University of Minnesota Extension provides recommendations for farmers on how much manure to apply, and this has 3 basic steps. Number 1, find out the nutrient needs of the crop. Number 2, calculate the actual nutrient availability in the manure. And number 3, divide the nutrient needs of the crop by the nutrient availability in the manure. We find nutrient availability in the manure by testing the manure for its nutrient content. This might be similar to how we conduct a soil test. Then, once we know the nutrient content, we will use a nutrient availability percentage that's provided from university research. But there's more than one nutrient in manure, so this requires farmers to choose one nutrient to focus on.
In Minnesota, you have to set rules. I mean, anywhere, we have to set rules. And we usually are concerned more about nitrogen losses because it can be so leaky from the soil. So our base recommendations are always to apply no more than the crop needs of nitrogen. If you overapply phosphorus or potassium or any of the other nutrients, that's fine. You'll just want to keep an eye on your soil tests, especially for phosphorus, to make sure you're not building up phosphorus over time.
Even though manure can be difficult to manage from a nutrient standpoint, there are a lot of major benefits from manure. First of all, it's a waste product, and we are finding a way to use that waste.
I like to say it recycles a waste product. We get worth from the waste product. The other thing is it's usually economically cheaper as well, because either you have the livestock on your own farm, so then you're recycling the nutrients there and it's essentially free. You don't have to buy as much fertilizer. But even if you're working out a deal with your neighbors, in a lot of cases, it can be cheaper. The other kind of positive of manure is that it comes with organic matter. So not only are you applying the nutrients that the crop needs, but you're applying the food to the soil as well for the soil microbiome. And that's another one of the big benefits of manure.
Manure has a lot of benefits as a fertilizer source, as it provides many different nutrients and often helps with water retention, given that it has organics in it. However, with manure, just like every fertilizer source, there are risks that are associated with putting extra nutrient on the field.
Whether it's commercial fertilizers or manure, we do have to worry about excessive nutrients, particularly nitrogen and phosphorus. Nitrogen because it leaks and leaves the system so easily, but phosphorus as well, because both of them are really limiting nutrients in our waterways. So when they get in high levels in our waterways, that's when we start seeing algal blooms and eutrophication and dead zones and things like that. And that's one of those things, like once a nutrient is in a certain form that can get into our water, it doesn't matter if it came from fertilizer or manure, it's the same thing. Like algae don't specifically look for manure supplied phosphate or anything like that.
Nutrient management can help us prevent these environmental losses, but it also puts a lot of weight on the farmer's shoulders. They need to know whether they're underapplying or overapplying, and they need to be successful in this. Overapplying can be just as much of a disadvantage to the farmer as underapplying.
When farmers don't find the correct nutrient rate, they can be on two sides of the coin. They can underestimate the crop need and fail to meet their maximum production and their maximum economic return. But if they overestimate the amount of nutrients that are needed, then they not only have invested too much in that given growing season, but they also might have applied too much that the crop is going to be able to take up. And as a result, there's going to be nutrients that are left over at the end of the year. And some of these nutrients are very mobile, like nitrate or phosphorus. And they might end up leaving the field where they invested their resources and they might end up into water systems and cause environmental problems such as eutrophication and nitrate leaching and accumulation of groundwater.
It is a bit inevitable that some farm nutrients will make their way to waterways. All we can do is use nutrient management to the best of our ability to try and reduce those losses. But there are some practices that we know can help lower those chances of nutrients being lost to water systems. The problem with these practices is that they're not always the most economical option for the farmer. And furthermore, any type of change that the farmer wants to put in on his farm poses a certain amount of risk. If we're changing practices, that means that we don't know if we're going to get the same production, and that can cost the grower their livelihood. But there are many groups that are affected by nutrient pollution, including you and I. So we need to use nutrient management and these better management practices, or BMPs, in order to reduce pollution loads.
When an action that's being done on a farm affects someone downstream or downwind, then it is realistically relevant to look at that practice and say, is this something that really is in the benefit of the farmer and all stakeholders that deal with those possible externalities? And really, I think more times than not, you look at a farmer, a conservationist, and a stakeholder such as a fisherman or someone that's using land or water or air for recreation, and they have very similar goals that are overlapping and overarching in their themes. It's really just about getting the communication in an effective manner. Farmers want nutrients to stay in their field because that's an efficient use of their input for their crops and their livelihood. Conservationists wants the nutrients to stay in the field because they don't want their biophysical realm of a water body to be polluted. And then the stakeholder or the sport fisherman, for example, they want to be able to carry out their recreational activities without impairment from wherever it may come from. So I think there's a kind of an overarching theme that you pick up in certain public policy pieces, certain ag pieces, and then certain kind of broad societal discussions. It's just connecting those in the right way that's sometimes difficult.
Conservationists, farmers, researchers, and even the public, we're all aiming for this same goal of reducing nutrient pollution. This can be pollution to both the air and the water. And reaching this goal can be a little bit of a challenge. While we all have the same end result in mind, we might have different ideas on how we need to get there. So communication is absolutely critical among all stakeholder groups.
There has to be an incentive for management practices to change. And that's really when public policy can start to come in and be really influential. That could be certain things like conservation programs. You could look at certain easements that give availability of funds or discounted tax rates to farmers because they're implementing practices that are societally beneficial. And really what the trick is to, if you can think of all of these stakeholder groups of farmers, scientists and agronomists, policymakers, the broader public, you can think of them all on a string. You really have to line up that nodes on a string. You really have to line up that message and argument. And so once you do that, you start to see where the benefits come.
Once we have all of our stakeholders on board and working toward this common goal of reducing nutrient pollution to the environment, we can begin to address some of the barriers that exist. And these barriers are more than just scientific. Some of them are also social.
I would say the first is a biophysical barrier. And so when you are changing a system or changing the management of a system, you don't see an immediate response, particularly in water quality is a great example. There's a lag time within when the change takes place until when you can actually quantify an improvement in water quality, for example. And that's going to be really dependent on the soil in the area, the hydrology of the water body, many kind of scientific biophysical aspects there. One place that I would say a large barrier exists is understanding if practices are to be changed, and improvements are to be sought after, who is going to pay not only the monetary, but kind of the societal cost of that? And that really gets into a fairly heated discussion sometimes, because there are stakeholders that may say, well, a farmer A does not have the right to impair water quality that affects my town. And so they should be solely paying for the change or the improvement in the management. And, it's kind of an interesting dilemma that you look at, who's going to pay for an improvement in environmental quality? Is it going to be the person who might be the source of that change, or is it the person who benefits from it? And really, I think the best answer is it depends, and it's probably going to be a mixture.
Considering the complexities and these issues surrounding nutrient management and in turn nutrient pollution, it brings us to wonder whether or not it would just be better for farmers to apply less. And again, this gets back to the social cost. Who pays for the reduced production that growers incur if they're reducing their nutrient inputs? A great example of where we might see a social cost of something could be the carbon markets. Both businesses and the public willing to pay to keep carbon in the ground rather than in the atmosphere. And these carbon markets get at this social cost. So not only the producers of the carbon, but also the people benefiting from reducing the carbon are helping to pay for this. That's just one example, though. But we see that we could possibly do something like this with nutrient management, although it might be very complex, as we have a hard time quantifying where exactly these nutrients are coming from and how they are cycling. This gets back to the overall goal of nutrient management, which is not to reduce farm productivity, but rather just reduce the amount of nutrients that are not being used by the crop. There are also a couple of other benefits to keeping crop production high, one of them being that we want to keep our rural economies going.
If we talk about, well, why can't just less inputs be used, essentially what you're telling someone is that they cannot utilize all of the opportunities they have to enhance their production in their system. We can talk about global food supply and things like that, but when you really look at trying to enhance environmental quality, there's a strong tie with a thriving rural economy as well. And so that's something that's important to take into consideration. So why can't we just apply less and reduce our production rates? Really, because the system and in biology and ecology, you talk about the system function and structure relationships. The agronomic and agricultural system we have functions in a way that optimum agronomic and economic production is needed to have a thriving rural economy.
While the outlook might look a little bleak for nutrient management and reducing some of the nutrient pollution issues that we have in the United States and in the Midwest, there is a lot of hope in the amount of people that are involved in these projects. John Jones, for instance, working with the Fertilizer Institute, is focused on research projects surrounding just these objectives of reducing nutrient pollution and also increasing communication amongst stakeholders.
What our goal is to discover and promote nutrient management and plant nutrition practices that benefit the farmer, the agricultural business, and all stakeholders involved. And that seems like a lofty goal, but small changes can really have a large impact. I could give just a great example of if you think about the improvements in soil testing, for example, that makes nutrient recommendations. An improvement of a soil test of 5 parts per million. So you increase your ability to understand that soil to within a greater degree of accuracy and precision. That reverberates into more accurate nutrient recommendations. That relates into more accurate applications of those nutrients where they're needed mostly within the field and the watershed and the county and the state. That means in a greater efficiency agronomically for the farmer, but then also economically as well. That means that there's less nutrients lost to the air, soil, and water that where we don't want them, and we have fewer societal costs. That also means if you think about ag business, that you have a more thriving customer for ag business. Purdue University does some large grower studies of farmers every few years. And one of the things that's so valued within the interaction of agronomists and farmers is trust, being able to trust someone in the recommendations that they're making. That trust is built when sound science leads to functional agronomy, which leads to decisions that are better for everyone involved. And so what the Foundation for Agronomic Research and the Fertilizer Institute does is we advocate for the science that's being conducted in ways that improves that system across all the whole spectrum.
So there you have it, sound science being put into action to balance the scale in nutrient management. The scientific field of soil fertility goes way beyond plant nutrition, like I said before. The environment is something we all share, and there's a lot of people affected by nutrient management, whether they know it or not. Improvement and change will come as we increase our understanding of each nutrient cycle and we communicate with all the stakeholders at the table.
Until next time, folks, be well,
be safe,
and be smart.